I truly see it as a way to give back to the universe, give back to the community. Those bees do so much good for the farm, and not just your crops, but just for all the flowers. And there are other pollinators. Honeybees are specific, the best pollinator for certain plants, just as bumblebees are the best for some and other pollinators. I see it as giving back to the community, giving back to them. When I'm at the farmer's market and a family comes up and I sell them a 2-pound jar of honey, those children are going to be eating my bees' honey for their breakfast, and I know that, and that's because I was there to help to middleman the honey. I don't make the honey, the bees do. But again, it's just such a beautiful thing, and such a deep satisfaction comes from keeping the bees alive and sending them out there. Again, it goes way past just the honey or the other products that the hive produces.
Welcome to Tangled Taproot, where we explore the unique stories of small-scale farmers in the Midwest. I'm Kristen.
I'm John Cowan.
And I'm Jackson.
And this is a production of Milk and Hummus.
Kristen, what's Milk and Hummus?
Well, we make flavorful, delicious hummus and ready-to-drink plant-based lattes that focus on locally sourced ingredients, sustainable packaging, and the humble chickpea.
Today, we're buzzing with excitement to introduce Joe Kaufman, a full-time beekeeper who traded his corporate suit for a beekeeper's veil. From two humble hives to over 50 thriving colonies, Joe's apiary produced an incredible 3,000 pounds of honey this year.
Wow.
Spanning 6 of the 7 USDA honey grades. In this episode, he takes us inside the fascinating world of bees, sharing insights on colony dynamics and the art of hive inspections and the battle against varroa mites. Varroa mites? Do you guys know how to say that? Varroa?
No, but if I listen, I might learn more.
You might learn more. Yeah. All right. We'll also dive into the rewards and challenges of urban beekeeping, the flavors unlocked by diverse nectar sources, and how Joe connects with his community through local farmers markets. So get ready to sweeten your perspective on honey, hives, and the craft of beekeeping. Let's get started.
Ooh.
I see what you did there.
I'm enticed.
I was fortunate enough to bring beekeeping to my parents when I was right before college. And so I read it on a top 10 list of things to do before you die. And I was like, yeah, why don't you
get stung by a bee?
No, not stung.
Whoa, like, calm down now.
Keep bees, because honestly, it's quite relaxing, and social creatures just like ants and whatnot. So definitely some magic behind the stewardship of beekeeping. And so Joe's going to really explain the intricacies to that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I feel like from what very little I know, there are so many nuances in taking care of this sort of delicate colony that we've all heard of bee population, honeybee issues throughout America, and hive flight and other mite issues.
Right.
Any person can, I mean, check your local laws, your county regulations, but a lot of times you have the right to
Have a hive,
yeah.
And eat it, too.
Yeah. It doesn't matter if you're in an urban setting or incredibly rural. You can get a bee box going.
How did you get started, John? Did you get a book at your local library or attend a conference? Or
usually it starts with a book. Internet? I mean, nowadays, I'm sure there's some YouTube channels you could just pop on, take a look, and it's pretty simple. And then also, there's always like a local group.
Yeah, with some other honeybee enthusiasts and some knowledge to be shared.
Yeah, I think the one that I was a member of was SIMBA. It was called like Southeastern Beekeepers Association. Yeah. But in Michigan, yeah, at the very least, you know, if you don't get honey, they're pollinating all your neighbors or your own garden, which is always helpful, contributing to flowers.
And if there's enough byproduct, you get to have some sweet rewards. Nectar of the gods? What did you learn was Joe's greatest challenge? Space? Is he rural or in the city?
He has hives in multiple places.
Oh.
Yeah.
He dabbles.
Yeah. So he has, two or three hives in the county, and then several on the rest of them on the farm, as I understand. So
cool.
That is cool. Yeah. Normalize just setting up hives anywhere, in your backyard, your vacation home.
A lot of people are afraid of bees, but they mistakenly think that stinging insects are bees. Yellow jackets are not bees.
Right, yeah, common misconception.
Honeybees are very docile. They have basically many roles, but they're Their main role is not to necessarily sting you. They're just going to end on you, if anything. And as long as you're not trying to take their honey, they'll go in peace. La Paz.
I had heard about all the different roles of bees in a colony and in a hive structure. And that was kind of neat to hear a little bit about those specific. I mean, there's more than I thought I remembered from.
I don't think there was ever like a magic school bus into a beehive, but.
That'd be a great idea.
Yeah.
This is close in sort of like mapping out the roles, the responsibilities of the queen, the drones, the worker bees, and basically the stewardship involved. From an agricultural standpoint, bees do a number of things to create the fruits and vegetables that we enjoy, make into wonderful dishes. And also the different grades, sort of like, I don't know if you want to call it analog to beer, your darkest buckwheat honey akin to like a dark stout, and then your lightest of light honeys. I think you actually mentioned
white.
Yeah, it's a white.
It's calling it white, which is interesting because even a pale thing, like we wouldn't think of it as white because it's probably a bit translucent. But interesting, yeah, terms and categories there with the color gradient.
And so you can take those different types and make a wonderful array of dishes and naturally sweeten and complement.
All right, now we're going to send it off to Joe Kaufman of Birch Creek Apiary. Enjoy the interview.
First off, what's your name? And let's get into the operation here.
My name's Joe Kaufman. I am a full-time beekeeper. I started off corporate and got an early out, which gave me an opportunity to do something I've always wanted to do as a hobby, and that's beekeeping. I got a couple of hives, started off, and just fell in love with it immediately. They are just amazing little creatures, and just fascinating, just watching them, let alone getting inside the hive. But they're everything they're made out to be. They are just little miracles in our natural world. And I started off with two hives. Next year went to four. Next year went to eight. Had some setbacks here and there. Tried to double up every year.
How many in one colony, how many bees would you anticipate being there?
50 to 60,000 bees.
Wow. Okay.
You have the queen, who is the mother of every bee in there, and you've got about 20 males called drones, one queen, and then approximately 49,980 female bees, worker bees. And they have different jobs. The workers have different jobs. Some are guard bees, nurse bees to take care of the cells and prepare the cells. You've got guard bees. People don't realize that, but when the bees come swarming out of there, there are guards who just sit there day and night at the entrance to the hive and watch for danger. And if they sense it, they send off pheromones. We're under attack, and all of the girls will come out of there to stop whatever it is.
And as a beekeeper, you want to avoid that, I'm assuming.
You want to avoid that. That's why we wear white. I'm not sure if bees, they're insects, if they have instincts or not, but the color black is the last thing in the world you want to wear. Most beekeeper suits are white. They just have a natural thing for bears. Bears love honey. I had a little black dog, and that poor thing would be out there just trotting around, and she'd get swarmed. If they see black, for some reason, they just think there's a bear coming, and the bears just destroy the whole hive to eat the honey, to do everything. So we have a few bears in Missouri. I've been lucky. Haven't had any trouble with any. I've got approximately this year, I had pretty close to 50 hives.
This year's 50?
50 in honey production. And now I'm more than that. And I'm a sixth-year beekeeper. I started off with two, and working my way up, splits, and acquiring more.
In 6 years, you've gone from two hives to over 50 that are producing honey?
Yes.
That's impressive.
Yes. So my first harvest, I was very fortunate. The first year, I took two nucleus hives and ended up with 110, 120 pounds of honey, which is very, very good. And this year, I got about 3,000 pounds of honey.
3,000?
3,000 pounds of honey. And other people might have honey just as good, but no one has better. This honey is just wonderful. And I have everything from, there's seven different color grades, USDA color grades, and I ended up this year producing six of them. I didn't get water white, but I have everything else. And I have...
So you have the pretty much the entire spectrum of grades of honey from very light to like a, what's it called, like a buckwheat type or darkness?
Dark amber.
Dark amber.
Everything's a shade of amber.
Oh, okay.
It goes water white, 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 extra light amber, and dark amber.
What contributes to the color?
The different nectars that they have from the plants will determine the color, the flavor, how quickly it sets up, how quickly it will crystallize, and all that's determined by that. The beekeeper, with the help of the bees, is responsible for getting the moisture level to a correct level. It has to be approximately 17% in order to keep it from fermenting in there. The bees dry the honey in their hive, and we test it when we bring the honey in. You test it to make sure it's within acceptable range, and you leave it in the honey house a little longer with the dehumidifiers going to get it to where you want. And again, from start to finish, just love every aspect. It's just what I always thought.
For the different grades, is there a different desirability of, or is it all matter of perspective, personal tastes, what have you?
Personal taste is a good one. People will ask me, what's the best honey you have? What's the best flavor? It's just a matter of to each his own.
Yeah,
it's
like
very quality. Best is qualitative.
Sure.
In America, most people like either white overall. They want the clover honey. White, light, delicate honey or extra light amber. In Missouri, certainly my experience, people would like to see a little more color to it. Wildflower. If you get just white honey, it's probably single source honey, one nectar source. Most of the wildflower honey that you get, which is what you buy, the farmer's market, is a combination of pollens. There were bees bringing in pollen from clover, blackberry, sumac. I mean, it could be any number, thistle, any number of sources. And there are so many good sources for pollen and nectar out there. And that's going to contribute to the color, the flavor. I don't like to say the darker honey stronger. Some people use that. A little more complex.
Okay.
That's the way I like to look at it.
Well, I mean, like, for example, a dark beer, they say that has a lot of polyphenols or blueberries, darker fruits. Berries have a lot more antioxidants per se. I wonder, or do you know if that is true as well for honey?
Scientists tell us it is true. There's a higher concentration of antioxidants. And I tell people, and it's the truth, although there's no scientific or medical backing that honey helps, local honey helps with allergies. It is true. I have an allergist, and he's the first one to say there's no scientific or medical data to support this, but you might try eating a teaspoon of honey every morning. That's straight from a Washu allergist.
Okay, yeah.
And the fact is, it's more than a wives' tale.
That speaks volumes.
The health and medical benefits, honey's clearly a legitimate superfood. It's good at so many levels. And the darker honey certainly has more antioxidants. You have more different pollens in there and nectars mixed in together. So just more of the good stuff.
So this year, over 3,000 pounds across 50 different or so hives, six of the seven grades. Where are you keeping your colonies to have such diversity? And
great question. Each area is different, but there's only so many resources in a given area. A bee will, when it leaves the hive, a worker, a forager in this case, going out looking for whatever the queen sends her out after. The queen tells them, we need water, we need pollen, we need nectar. And then the scouts go out and locate a certain area and come back with the highest concentration of whatever it is they're seeking on that given day. And she does a little dance, shows them the way, and they go right to it. They'll only fly 2 miles, but they'll fly 2 miles in any direction. So basically a 4 mile radius with the hive, the colony being the nucleus of the circle, they've got a 4 mile radius they'll travel. Well, there's a finite amount of resources in that area. So each area is different. Down where my farm is, 6 or 8 colonies of bees on one property with no other bees within 4 miles of it. Different areas are different. Right here, where I'm at in St. Louis, is a tremendous area. There's a tremendous amount of resources here. So once you get bigger than 6 or 8 colonies of bees, certainly you have to start looking for other properties to keep those. And along the 44 corridor, I have bees in St. Louis City, St. Louis County, Ellisville, just outside of Union, just outside of Sullivan, and then a host of areas down around me. And then I got some great honey from a little bit north, Marys County. I'm basically Phelps County, Crawford County, Marys County, St. Louis County with mine right.
There is some urban hives, and that would probably produce, I'm guessing, wildflower honey, or is there a specific type of honey from these more urbanized areas versus, let's say, and I'm not sure if this is part of your operation, but having a hive in an orchard?
Hive in an orchard is usually not a good idea. They have to be pollinated. The almonds in California are a perfect example. They bring in millions of colonies of bees to pollinate the orchard, that pollinate all the trees in the orchard, and then they get the bees out of there, send them home, because you almost have to spray. When you're doing something like that, you have to spray. And that's okay as long as they're not spraying on blossoms. But by the same token, you get the bees out of there. Most orchards, most fruit blooms for a week, okay? And you're only going to get, and if it rains that week, you might get very little to nothing off of it. The bees just can't get to it. So
that's more of a service than the beekeeper's providing a service to the orchard versus the orchard really providing enough pollen or honey.
Right. They're not going to get any honey out. Okay. They don't bring home honey. You have people from, I want to say, just about every state in the country sending bees out there. That commercial beekeepers have two aspects to their job, either three, either just make bees and sell bees, or make honey and sell honey, or full-time pollination. And pollination's actually where the money's at. It's the easiest. That's big. Certain crops have to be pollinated by honeybees. Almonds being one, blueberries being another, oranges being another.
So a farmer will essentially pack up their colony, drive it to a section of the orchard, let the bees do their thing for a given week or two, and then call it quits, and then they get a payment for the service of the 50,000 workers.
Right. There'd be no almonds without the bees. They haul truckloads, semis full of bees.
Oh, wow.
From almost, I know three commercial beekeepers here in Missouri that send multiple truckloads with literally thousands of colonies. And every state in the country, I'm wanting to say, does that, with the exception of Alaska and Hawaii. Everybody sends bees to Hawaii. And then a lot of them will just take those bees and move them to another site. There's some crop in Texas that they need bees for. But the blueberries up north, oranges, and there are a couple others. I'm not at that point. I never.
Gotcha. So focus.
I make honey.
Honey.
I yes. make honey yes. and bees.
Okay. So right now, when you're making honey, it could be, like I said, the six different grades. Are you going to collect honey and then, I guess, process it right away after a certain, let's say, plants bloom? Or are you going to let things continue on? Or how do you get a consistent color? Yeah, I'm not sure. How do you get to, let's say, just a dark color versus a light?
Well, that's a good question that comes up quite often at the farmers markets. I'm in a very good spot. There's three levels of beekeepers: the hobbyist, the sideliner, and commercial beekeepers. I'm in the middle. I'm a sideliner. The basic traditional is if you have 1 to 24 colonies of bees, you're a hobbyist. And 20 colonies of bees sounds like quite a bit.
It is.
That's a million bees.
Right.
You've got a million bees. You have that. 50,000 in every colony. But you're a hobbyist. If you have 25 to 399 colonies, that's classified as a sideliner. And if you have over 400, and there are beekeepers here in this country with 10 and 12,000 colonies of bees, but they have crews working
for them,
and they have all their own equipment,
sure.
Then you're a commercial. Well, the neat thing is I'm in the middle. The little guys and the big guys, they harvest their honey, they bring in the frames and extract it, and they mix it all together. Every frame, just about every frame, certainly every box is different color. When they put it all together like that, the little guys and the big guys, it means out into one color. That's why if you go to a store, the dark stuff and the extra light is going to mean out to a medium. I'm using the word mean out as an arithmetic mean, but it means out and it all ends up the same color. When I start looking, and I start, when I bring the boxes of honey in, the honey frames, I inspect every one. I separate the light ones from the dark ones, from the medium ones. That's why when you come to my stand at the farmer's market, I've got five different colors of honey up there. I can separate them, and it gives people more of an option. Everyone's good. Everyone's different. That's where I'm at right now, and that's a good place to be. I have enough bees. I won't run out of honey. I can produce and sell honey 12 months a year, but not like the big people who just, you just, again, you mix it all together, and small beekeepers do because they don't have that much, a few hundred pounds. So that's why I have different colors for sale, and some other beekeepers can do that as well, but you don't see it generally. They just mix it all together, and it ends up one color. That's their color for this year.
Yeah, I would imagine that having that variety is a pretty big advantage, especially with sales. People are able to pick and be educated at the same time if they're not familiar with the different grades. Be pleasantly surprised with a variety, either getting a light and versus a dark, doing a little comparison, depending on how they're going to use it. So honey is the end game, right? For you. I mean, it's not always in the bee box, correct? I mean, it's got to be accumulated, or at least the surplus has to be accumulated in order for you to bring to market. What's the daily task list or activity list look like?
Well, it's different every month. The easiest months, January, February, and March, and December. Basically, November through March, the bees are pretty inactive. The temperature, the bees can't fly if it's under 50 degrees. They can't leave the hive. Bees don't hibernate. They sit in there and they keep the inside of that hive 80 degrees year-round. Well, it gets warmer than that in the summer. But it's a minimum of 80 to protect the brood, the eggs, larvae, the cat brood that are sitting there so they don't freeze, and the queen. The queen's very, I don't want to say fragile. I mean, they feed her. Queen can't eat, can't sting. Queen can do one thing only, lay eggs. And that's the essence of your hive. Every bee in there, she laid an egg. No matter what it is, male, female, worker, forager, she's responsible for it. To get back to what you were just talking about, I don't do this because I need to. I retired. I get pension checks. I do it because I love it, and I see it as a way to give back to the universe by keeping all those healthy bees, and their work goes way beyond making honey for me to sell at the market. But it's just a way to give back to the universe. The bees are under a lot of pressure right now because of climate change is a big one. But
I heard of like varroa mites.
Varroa mites are number one, even more than climate change. Climate change might somehow come along and try to take over. But the biggest threat over the years, what's decimated the wild bees, was the introduction from Europe, varroa destructor, varroa mite. And they don't actually kill the bees, but they vector diseases. They vector the diseases. They weakened their immune system.
Have you lost any hives to this or any other, I guess, pathogenic organism or?
Colony loss is a natural thing. It's natural. No matter how well you manage it, no matter how well you take care of your bees, 20% loss, losing one out of five hives over the winter, is natural. There's an old saying, all roads lead to varroa. So they probably caused it that they were in there. If another disease or it weakened the hive so that small hive beetles or wax moths or some other pest got in there and they couldn't fight them off.
And I heard, I mean, 20% sounds pretty great. I mean, as I've heard in 2022, 2023, I mean, some folks oftentimes are, I think, between roughly 50% loss is what I was reading about this morning due to whatever the case may be, either pathogenic or pathogen related or otherwise. But do you have to dispose of your boxes, or is there a way to, I don't know, ensure when you're replacing the, I don't know, if the bees swarmed and went away, or is there a protocol that you follow that helps to kick things off again?
You'd expect it. If wax moths or small hive beetles get in there, they make a mess of it. They make a mess once they run the bees off. But varroa destructor, there's no trace behind. It's a parasite that attaches to the bee's abdominal area, and they feed off the bee. And it's unfortunate. they get into the cell before they close off the cell, capped brood, where they laid the egg, they let it turn into a larva, they give it some more bee bread, some more food, and then they cap it off and let it grow and do its thing. And there's Varroa mites already in there and in there with it. So when they're hatched, they've been fighting this for the last 3 weeks. It takes about 3 weeks from the time the egg is laid until the bee is full grown and hatches. And they'll come right out of there with Varroa on them, and it weakens the bee, the hive. But once the bees leave, the Varroa leaves. Unfortunately, they're all over the country. Your foragers are going to come in contact with other bees, and that's how they'll bring one back to the hive.
It's sort of like poultry. You have these domesticated ducks or chickens, and then they get in contact with the, let's say, wild ducks or other birds, and then they bring home an avian flu virus or something, and then unfortunately have to call those animals. But as a beekeeper, you're saying you have to monitor for these mites, any other indications of, like you said, wax moths or disease. It's simply not just grabbing a bunch of bees, throwing them in a box and letting them have their thing and then taking honey. It's got to be much more than that. I mean, what goes into, I guess, the tasks of a beekeeper?
Well, hive inspections are what we're looking at. And then, of course, there are treatments to keep down the mites and some of the other things. And I use organic treatments. There's several options there. Daily, the most important thing you do being a beekeeper is making sure that hive is optimal condition for them to thrive. You have to make sure your queen right. You've got a good queen. The virgin queen flies off and does a mating flight. She mates with maybe 6 males, and then she comes back to the hive and starts to lay eggs. And she'll lay 1,000 to 1,500 eggs a day every time, and she can do this for 3 years. 3, 4 years. You'll always get 2 years out of them. And she just went out and mated one time. Every time she lays an egg, it's individually inseminated. She one sperm cell to one egg before it goes in, and it, again, it's just amazing the way they do that. But to lay 1,000 to 1,500 eggs a day during the spring, late winter, spring, early summer, and then it backs off, and the population goes back down for the winter because they can't feed that many bees. They build up for the nectar flow. So every month is different, but about once a month, you need to get into every single hive you have and look at it and head off problems. And you do what's called a hive inspection. And I have a lot of hives to inspect. It's fun. Most novice, beginner, or the biggest problem they have is they inspect too much because they want to get into the hive and they're disturbing the bees and stressing them perhaps. And the queen won't lay as she should. And the bees get a little defensive and on edge. But for us, for most people, you want to get in there once a month, certainly March, April, May, June, July, August, and September, and see exactly what's going on, what's going wrong. Make sure they're queen right, your queen is good, and she's laying her pattern. Make sure there are no pests in there that are bothering them, and make sure they have enough room to grow.
Do you use, I guess, the more traditional framed hives for your process?
Yes, the hives I use is the standard for the world, Langstroth hives. They were invented mid-1800s, and it is such a perfect design. They've changed the materials somehow using plastic frames or plastic foundation, but otherwise, it's exactly the same as when he invented it. Before that, the standard for the world was skep hives, and you had to tear the hive apart to harvest the honey, and you basically destroyed the hive and killed all the bees, and you started over next year. So the Langstroth hives, it's just ideal for bees, maximizes honey production, safety, comfort, gives the bees a chance to thrive, and there's no room for improvement. It's really it's just spectacular.
And in your hive arrangement, let's say one hive unit, do you have a certain configuration where you're adding boxes or there's a brood section, or I forgot the terminology, is it called a super?
Very good, yes. Have 3 different choices for your brood boxes, which is where the queen lives. A brood box, you have 3 different size boxes, deeps, mediums, and shallows. The shallows are just for making comb honey. I don't do that. It's a lot of work. and I don't like coal money that much.
And that's what you find, like literally just with the wax, with the honey, and it's just capped off in a little tin, or not tin, but
whatever they're selling it in.
Right, yes, right.
Exactly. And it's right. And that's, and before they learned to extract it, and before you had Langstroth hives, that was the only way to eat honey. That was the only way to eat it. You can squish it out of there, but basically, anyhow, you have brood boxes where the queen lives. You can have a single deep box. It's a 9-inch tall box, or you can have a double deep, which is what I traditionally use, or I am switching to a little more challenging but technique where you use for a brood box for the queen, one honey super, which is a 6-inch box compared to a 9-inch deep box, and one honey super and one deep. And the queen stays down there. That's where she lays her eggs, and you place honey supers on top of there. And if you have drawn out comb from the year before, you can just stack boxes on there. This helps reduce the chance of swarming and gets the queen going. When she sees how much room she has, she really starts laying. If she was only laying 1,000 eggs a day, she might kick it up. Oh, we need more bees. And she'll kick it up to 1,300, 1,400, 1,500 eggs a day.
So that increases your efficiency, increases the amount of bees that are able to go out and forage for nectar, for pollen. Is it nectar or pollen? I'm sort of...
They bring them both in. They got to have both. Pollen is the protein. Nectar is the carb, the sugar. So they need both. They have to eat both. They mix them together and put it in the bottom of a cell, and it's called bee bread. And the queen lays an egg on top of that. When it turns into a larva, it's got its food right there. It needs the pollen, the protein, just as humans do, to build muscle. And then it needs the carb, the sugar, for energy. But again, the hive has to have three resources. They have to have water, they have to have pollen, and they have to have nectar in order to make honey, in order to survive. And again, the queen and they tell the scouts what they need that day. And at different times in the year, they're still bringing in pollen, but not as much in the summer as they are late winter. We're pretty lucky here in Missouri. We don't have to feed pollen. Very few people have to feed pollen. There are so many big pollen producers. The red maples start to bud in February, and that's just a great source of pollen. You'll see them bringing it in, and their little legs are just, their whole body's just covered with it. So they're storing up their pollen right then and there, getting ready, and they're eating the honey that they have until the nectar flow starts, which in Missouri, 1st of May. Some of the first flowers to come up will be dandelions, blackberries. These all bloom in the first part of May. Great nectar sources.
Do you recommend people keep dandelions out instead of weed them, or what's your thoughts on the matter?
If you really want to be a naturalist, that's a good way to go. I hate to see people spray them because the bees will come over and get on there. But if you stop and think about it, there's 20 or 30,000 foragers coming out of that hive, bees that are coming out of there. So leaving 5 dandelions in your yard isn't going to save a bee.
All right.
Isn't going to save a bee. So if you like a nice, pretty lawn, that's fine. Much better for your lawn and for the bees is clover.
Oh, okay.
Dandelion only blooms for a week. Clover blooms and produces nectar for 3 months. That's why you see clover honey is one of the dominant honeys for the commercial beekeeper, something where they can just continuously get it instead of, see, the bees can't fly if it's raining or if it's cold. The blackberries bloom for a week, makes great honey, great, great honey. But it blooms for a week. And if it rains, the first day they opened up, bees can't get on there. The next day, it's wet. The bees can't get on there. And then if it rains the next day, they could possibly miss the whole bloom.
So supply-demand standpoint, blackberry honey could be pretty scarce or rare?
It is pretty rare. It is hard. They're very small blossoms. But boy, is it a delicious honey. Normally what you can get, like with mine, I have a lot of blackberries at my apiary, my farm. And the blackberries just, it's delicious, but what you get is hints of blackberry. Again, your wildflower honey, getting pure blackberry, probably isn't going to happen. But about the same time, you've got the black locust. The clover is starting to bloom. If it's mature clover from the year before, it's starting to bloom in May. And you have all these different flowers that are out there, these blossoms that are producing for them.
So apart from the different types of honey right now, are you ever considering diversifying into, let's say, selling pollen or royal jelly or there's like a resin that's
propolis.
Yeah.
No.
All right. Yeah.
I'm at a point where I am looking at, I probably will be selling a few bees next year.
Okay.
Now that I have enough, I can produce bees pretty efficiently at this point. And so I might be selling some bees, but people continuously ask me for pollen. What a healthy thing to add. Just a secret weapon of a lot of professional athletes and bodybuilders. It's just, again, like you can't just say.
It requires specialized tools and equipment and processes and ultimately distracts from.
Right. I have enough bees right now and doing the farmers markets. When I first started, I had a market garden. I grew flowers, which I love doing. I was growing some tomatoes and small vegetables because I already have a stand at the farmer's market, and it's just natural products from the farm. Bees are considered livestock, and it's just part of the farm. But I don't do that anymore because there's only one of me, and I have enough bees now. Again, doing hive inspections and taking care of the bees, as well as the honey and marketing the honey. A full-time job for one man.
Sure, absolutely. So, I mean, let's just step back a little bit. You always were not a beekeeper. You mentioned you had a corporate job. And so I guess why did you get into agriculture and specifically beekeeping? What's the appeal? What's the draw compared to your previous background?
I've always been an outdoorsman. Love to camp, love the outdoors, love nature, hiking, camping, mountain biking, fishing, anything. I just love being out there. I would rather be outside than inside. I come inside as a last resort. I'd rather be outside. And then especially if you're on a farm or someplace remote, rural area, it's just so special. And I've always loved it and always been fascinated by bees and always loved honey. So I wanted to get them. And so I got just as a hobbyist and just loved it so much. That started a honey business, started an apiary. Once you get them and you open up a hive and there's 50,000 bees in there, and the average person is going to think, oh, they're going to come flying out of there and sting you. You pull out a frame, it's got a couple thousand bees on it, and they're all just sitting there looking at you, and they'll climb over onto your glove, and they're not trying to sting you. They're just, as long as they don't feel threatened. They feel threatened, oh, they'll sting. But most of the bees are just so sweet that they're just amazing, and they're happy you're there. It's almost like, are you my daddy? They know their mama, they don't know their daddy, and so they're just that's just seems to be the attitude that they have towards you, and you can hold it up and they don't feel threatened, and you've got thousands of bees which could literally take your life if they wanted to. They don't want to do that.
So it's really a unique, I guess, magical, natural experience being a steward for these insects. It's something that's basically providing a home for the bees, but then they're giving you so much back and drawing you in.
Yes, I've lived a very blessed life. So happy, so fortunate. I started off corporate. I left corporate and became a full-time yoga teacher. Did that for 15 years and got the bees. And then I've moved into full-time beekeeping at this point. I truly see it as a way to give back. Give back to the universe, give back to the community. Those bees do so much good for the farm, and not just your crops, but just for all the flowers. And there are other pollinators. Honeybees are specific, the best pollinator for certain plants, just as bumblebees are the best for some and other pollinators. I see it as giving back to the community, giving back to them. When I'm at the farmer's market and a family comes up and I sell them a 2-pound jar of honey, those children are going to be eating my bees' honey for their breakfast, and I know that, and that's because I was there to help to middleman the honey. I don't make the honey, the bees do. But again, it's just such a beautiful thing, and such a deep satisfaction comes from keeping the bees alive and sending them out there. Again, it goes way past just the honey or the other products that the hive produces.
I read somewhere that keeping bees or being able to experience a hive is something that everyone really should experience. It's sort of one of these very, very unique experiences that it's like a bucket list item or just something that people really need to live, to appreciate.
Yep, I agree. I'd recommend it to everyone that comes up. If someone says, I've always wanted bees, my immediate response is, you should get some. You should get some. Most of the local government agencies here realize the benefits. And here in suburbia, I'm in the city of St. Louis, and it's a law. I can have 5 colonies of bees on my property, irregardless of how big the lot is. And each little township is the same way. Very rare that someone would, that a government agency would prohibit keeping bees. I'm sure there are towns where it's just not appropriate, but they're in the city, they're in every suburb you can think of. And it's just wonderful. And again, I've just encouraged my son, Dr. Justin, as I call him, to for my grandchildren to put some hives at his house. And he lives in a great area for bees, but in a subdivision, and we can set it up so that no one's going to get stung. Not going to happen. And they can observe the bees and understand that aspect of it. Again, it's just so good. Just such a critical part. You see the little advertisements, no bees, no food. No bees, no life. We lose the bees, life on this planet. And I'm not a scientist, but I can see how there's a great deal of truth to that. Other pollinators could pick up some of the slack and we wouldn't get honey, but there are just certain blooms, certain blossoms that are just made for honeybees. And other pollinators might like it, but the bees are just the masters. And as far as getting in there and pollinating, spreading the pollen, that's how they do the pollen. It's by accident. They go in to gather pollen, then they go to another flower, perhaps another one in another area, and they leave some pollen, they pick up some pollen, and that's basically how it works. So just win-win-win all the way through. But I'd recommend to anybody who has a chance, if you can do it, a little bit of an initial outlay in cash. There's all sorts of help, bee clubs, where people that are just so happy that you're going to pick it up, you're going to start keeping bees, they're happy to help you. I've helped quite a few people, and there's bound to be a bee club in your area with knowledgeable people who can get you through the first year or two, in which case you'll still have questions. You won't know everything, but you'll feel a little more comfortable with what you're doing, your inspections especially, and keeping the bees alive and healthy.
Nice. Now, that's outstanding. I know that some places where the bees have, whether they've gone away from disease or pesticides, and there's really not the right types of other insects to sort of take their place. And there's a great inefficiency of people hand pollinating with like little brushes, I think, in some countries, which is unfortunate. And then for those worried about being stung by bees, I mean, a lot of times people think, let's say, of yellow jackets are bees, or other these stinging insects are honeybees. And in fact, that's not the case.
No, bees can sting, but they don't. Except for it's a last resort. They die as soon as they sting. They're gone. So the only reason they're going to sacrifice their life is to try and stop you from hurting their sisters and their mother and destroying the hive. If they feel they're under attack, they'll sting.
Basically, has there, like, especially during the honey harvest, I would say that's probably the most vulnerable, or I'm assuming the most vulnerable time for being stung. Have you ever experienced any, I don't know, challenges or stinging events or anything at all that's like unexpected?
Honey harvest wasn't too bad, doesn't seem to be too bad. It's hard, heavy work, but you move the bees out of the honey supers down into their boxes. Most of them will move down. They move downward, and you're taking the boxes off the top, the excess honey. You have to leave honey for the bees. Bees are expensive. If you have to buy new bees every year, won't be much of an operation, whether it's backyard beekeeper are bigger. You can't buy new bees every year. So you have to think of the bees first. So you're taking the excess honey from the top and leaving them. Here in Missouri, they need about 70 pounds of honey to get through the winter. By the end of next month, there'll be about 5,000 bees, whereas there was 50 or 60,000. In the summer, there'll be about 5,000 bees to get through the winter. And again, they keep it 80 degrees in there. They just put the queen and the babies in the middle. They gather around them and just sit there and beat their wings, just very slowly. And doesn't matter if it's 10 degrees below zero outside. Last January, we had a cold January. It's 80 degrees inside that hive without insulation, just from them generating heat, just sitting there flapping their wings. And they keep it nice for the entire winter, and they stay inside. They got their honey. It's warm. As long as it's pest-free, you're set. They have a good chance of making it through the winter.
Little winter custodians of the hive. Is there any questions that I didn't ask you that you wanted to go into?
No, that's pretty much what I do. Again, I don't need to do this. I'm retired, and I'm fortunate enough to have a couple of pensions. I do this for the enjoyment and, again, giving it back. There's money in it, but I guess one of the, I guess you could call it a negative side of is if you're in my position, you become a bit of a honey snob. You get real, real particular when you have access to this honey. And then I have three other honeys that are wild looking that other beekeepers want to share. And, oh, try some of this, Joe. And they give me some of their honey. So
more connoisseur than a snob, I'd say. And that's not a bad thing. I mean, when you know something well, I mean, then why not?
Be real particular. And again, there are just so many different flavors. And when you go from water white to dark amber, there's so many different flavors to go with those colors that are in there and different shades within the color. And it's just such a beautiful thing. I would recommend it to anybody that's interested. Reach out to the local bee club. You can attend the meetings usually for free, rub shoulders with beekeepers, and then they can help you get set up so it wouldn't be positive. But I'm more than happy to help anybody that in my area with getting started, and I recommend it to anybody.
Well, thank you. Where can people find your honey?
I'm selling at farmers markets. The name of my company is Birch Creek Apiary. I'm launching a Facebook page, Birch Creek Apiary, and have some interesting pictures, if nothing else. I'm just listing the farmers markets that I sell them. I don't sell online at this point. I'm not at that point. I don't know that I ever will be, but at least can see what's going on and where to get it and how to get a hold of me if they need to.
What farmers markets are you at currently?
I'm finishing up. All my markets that I have left are down by my farm in Rolla Downtown Farmers Market. But I'm really looking forward to the Tower Grove markets, holiday and winter markets.
Tower Grove holiday and winter markets. Yeah, those will be amazing, especially if the winter temperatures are more mild as they have been. So
it's a nice change of pace. And I'm at a point where I'll take 20 degrees over 95 degrees myself. So actually quite enjoyable.
Well, thanks a lot, Joe. Appreciate your time today. And we look forward to trying some more of your honey and getting out to see the bees here.
My pleasure.
Thanks again to Joe Kaufman of Birch Creek Apiary. You can find his flavorful honey at the Rolla Farmers Market as well as the Tower Grove Holiday and Winter Farmers Markets. He will soon have a page set up on Facebook.
Well, this is another production of Tangled Taproot. Here with Milk and Hummus, I'm Kristen.
I'm John.
And I'm Jackson.
If you enjoyed what you heard, please like, share, and review us. Again, thank you so very much for listening and taking the time. We take a lot of pleasure in interviewing local farms and farmers and letting you know what's going on out there, folks. We'll be happy to answer your questions if you can email them to tangledtaproot@milkandhummus.com. Until we see you next time.
Ciao for now.
Bye.